This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. A few years ago, I rushed my dog to the local animal emergency room after he'd been hit by a car. As I anxiously waited to see the veterinarian, I watched equally panicked dog owners max out their credit cards without a second thought. And we're talking about thousands of dollars of medical treatment. An orthopedic surgeon put my doggy back together, and he's doing just fine. It was a poignant scene in that waiting room, and I remembered it while reading Michael Shaver's new book, One Nation Under Dog. While he writes about obsessive dog owners, $700 pet strollers, pricey organic food, canine antidepressants, and doggy fashion shows, he also explores the growing intensity that people feel for their dogs and their willingness to sacrifice for their pet's well-being. Michael Shaver is a writer. He's a journalist. He writes currently for Slate for the New Republic, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Michael Shaver, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You're very welcome. You got a dog for the first time.
I did.
I guess smallish St. Bernard dog.
Small for a St. Bernard. We joke that he's a teacup St. Bernard, which means he's only 100 pounds.
Like one of those gigantic Starbucks coffees, right?
Right, yeah.
Exactly. And you got Murphy by going to one of these places in Pennsylvania, one of these places to buy dogs. What happened?
No, it was a shelter. It was in New Jersey. And, you know, one of the things that has changed in the last few years is that adopting a dog from a shelter has become a much simpler procedure. You used to sort of have to go down to the pound, and it was in the bad part of town and miserable, and you sort of take what you could get there. And for a lot of people, it was a sort of traumatic experience because you knew that whatever you didn't take home, whoever you didn't take home might be euthanized, and so on. There is this website now called Pet Finder.
Right.
It's one of a number of similar websites, which let you search dogs in pretty well every shelter in the country. So you can search based on, you know, what sort of dog you want, what sex, age, size, etc. And I'm not sure why we settled on Murphy. I kind of liked the idea of a dog with droopy jowls. It seemed sort of mournful and sweet. But I had no idea what I was doing. And we drove out to this place in New Jersey, this shelter where he was. And, you know, I remember as we drove, we were saying to each other, my wife and me, you know, we're never going to spend a lot of money on veterinary care, and we're never going to buy him this sort of stuff, and he's going to eat basic food. There's no reason for him to have that frou-frou dog food. And you know, I don't need to tell anyone who has a pet that once he came home, things got a little more complicated.
Well, this is really your entree into the world of dog ownership. You
right.
didn't grow up with dogs as a kid. But your book is about some of this really hilarious, obsessive, kind of crazy stuff, which I do want to talk about. But it's also about this relationship that you have observed between people and their dogs. What do you think explains the kind of intensity of that relationship?
You know, I think that the way people treat pets, the way people keep pets, has always been kind of a funhouse mirror reflection of the society. It was true 100 years ago when the number of people who could actually keep purely pets, that is, dogs that didn't have to do anything to earn their supper, was very small. And Thorsten Veblen, the sociologist, the guy who coined the term conspicuous consumption,
right.
thought of these lap dogs as kind of the ultimate emblem of that, because it was like rich people being able to say to the world, hey, look at me, I'm so rich, I can feed this animal, and it doesn't have to do anything in exchange for that. It doesn't have to, you know, herd sheep or pull a cart or anything like that. Nowadays, it reflects all kinds of other things in our society. I mean, it's obviously democratized. Everybody can have a pet pretty
sure.
well. About a little more than 60% of the households in the country have one. And the bond is this very, very intense bond. You know, you can almost see it if you go to an old pet cemetery. There are some that are like 100 years old. And the oldest headstones will say things like, you know, here lies Fido, a loyal servant. And you get into the 20th century and it'll say, like, here lies Fido, man's best friend. And nowadays you see these, you know, daddy's little girl and mommy misses you, and you know, it's really become like a member of the family. You know, when was the last time you saw a doghouse that was actually used to house a dog? I mean, we talk about sending people to the doghouse, but actually they live inside with us.
Do you think there's some parallel between how passionate people feel about their dogs, and even the kind of obsessiveness that people have mm-hmm. about their dogs, but also the way that, not all children, but a lot of children are raised in this country, which is that you have parents who are, you know, interested in everything that they eat and where they go to school when they're in 3 years old. The kind of obsessiveness about children has been transferred to an obsessiveness about pets.
Well, I think, again, you can learn a great deal about society just from looking at pets. I say that an anthropologist from Mars could come down, just check out the inside of a PetSmart, and you could learn a great deal about society that on the surface has nothing to do with pets. And it is a great image of our attitude towards nurturing and family and care. As they've sort of become members of the family, we use the same logic in deciding what's right for them in terms of their feeding, in terms of their behavior, in terms of their washing. We use the same logic as we use for our human family members.
And we even say mommy and daddy to our dogs.
We do. Some like 83% of people, according to one survey I saw. You know, one theory, which I subscribe to, about why this happened is that you see the population of pets start to grow faster than the human population in the late 60s and 70s, which is around the same time as it became much easier to live far from your family. Divorce began going up. People left kind of tight-knit urban neighborhoods or small towns and moved to more isolated suburban communities. And this, as the sort of old-fashioned social support networks receded, people leaned on their pets more. They'd always had pets and always loved pets, but the terms of the love were transformed by this. And in turn, the things we do sort of in public, the shopping we do and the behaviors we do, they also changed.
Now, you had to put your dog on some medication
right.
because he had a barking problem that your neighbors did not appreciate.
Right. You know, I live in Philadelphia, and I live in a row house. And so we'd brought this dog home from a shelter. He was 18 months old. He'd had a pretty rough 18 months as far as we can tell. And, you know, our neighbor said, hey, your dog barks from the minute you leave to the minute you come home at night. And he'd go to the bathroom in the house. He would try to escape. One time he got on our bed, and there was a window behind the bed, and he ate through the screen and ran out across the roof. Our neighbor a few doors down was reading to her kids. And you know, she had her back to the window, and the kids were looking at her, and all of a sudden started yelling because there was a giant St. Bernard head in the window. And she had to go out on the roof and was remarkably pregnant at the time and drag the St. Bernard into safety. We came home, and there was a little note on her door that said, "We got your dog."
But we're talking about a very anxious dog.
Right, it was very anxious, and I laugh about it, but he was actually in great distress, and at the time it was something that we were really, really concerned and upset about. As you said, I'd never had a dog before. I didn't really know what to do. And like anyone, I just sort of looked at the people around me and copied them. And at one point the vet said, well, you know, there's a pill for that, you know. And sure enough, it was a tricyclic antidepressant, the same as exists in the human market, mm-hmm. the same as I have ingested.
Did it work?
You know, it didn't work alone. It did work. He has had a tremendous effect. I don't think you can just medicate anyone and have that be the end of it. But combined with some behavior stuff we did and some other advice we'd gotten, yes, he's much more comfortable, much happier. And, you know, it was a tough thing, but again, it reflects the kind of where we are as a country. It was once upon a time that you would, you know, the dog arrived after the kid and the house with the picket fence and often a homemaker in the house. Now we're a country of two career couples and the dog coming sort of earlier in the process too. So there are lots of latchkey dogs out there in the country, including ours. We didn't really have a choice about whether he was going to be a latchkey dog or not. Luckily, you know, I've been off writing a book for the last couple of years.
So you've been home.
So now he's home with me and
But that's an interesting point, that on the one hand, while people have dogs and are lavishing a lot of attention on dogs, people are also very busy, whether one career, two jobs, or whatever, but oftentimes not home, and you've got these dogs home right. alone.
Pets and their issues really reflect the country. You know, one of the things I found, I went at one point, one of the most fun things I did in reporting this book, I went to visit this company that manufactures chew toys. And you would think of chew toys as, you know, most dogs would be happy with, like, a tennis ball. Right. They don't care. But you have these chew toys, and they're marketed like Baby Einstein. You know, mental enrichment for your and for cats too.
Them, yes.
And there was even at the last Pet Goods show I went to, there was a mental enrichment for fishes. But, you know, I think it preys on a lot of those same parental insecurities that you cited, you know, because no one wants to have the dumbest lab on the block. But there's also another thing it reflects, which is that, you know, this company I visited was in the exurbs of Austin, Texas. So I'd be driving back to my hotel in Austin at night after hanging out with them. And on the highway the other way, there was just chock-a-block traffic of people going home to their exurban communities. And I thought, well, there's the market.
Exactly.
These are people who work very hard. They work 8, 9, 10 hours a day. They commute 45 minutes, an hour each way. That's a lot of dogs who are alone for a long time. And these toys were, I mean, they were incredible. They, you know, the food is hidden someplace in the middle, and the dog has to figure out how to chew in a certain way and manipulate it in a certain way to get the food out. And, you know, it would take a while, and it is mentally stimulating. It's actually physically quite stimulating for the dog. The idea is at the end of it, the dog is sort of exhausted and mm-hmm. satisfied and happy, which is great for the dog. For the humans, there's also a selfish element involved, which is that at the end of it, the dog is not going to chew up your sofa because
so
it's so
have you lavished these toys on your dog?
You know, I have a St. Bernard,
Murphy.
And
what do they
I love
do?
Him. He's no rocket scientist. he's not even a chew toy scientist. I have brought him home almost everything I've gone out and reported on in the time I've been working this book. And for the most part, he looks at it, sniffs it a couple times, then goes back to sleep.
Yeah, there's a lot of sleeping, I think, in a dog's life. Though reading your book, I was reminded, and I do think that people do need dogs in a way, that dogs do provide a unique kind of nurturance. And I remember being in Barcelona about 5 or 6 years ago, and there were homeless people, as there are, of course, in all cities. But what struck me was how many homeless people had not just one dog or two dogs, but a pack of dogs. And they'd all be together, you know, begging on the street, frankly. But nonetheless, I was so struck by the kind of relationship that you saw between this homeless man or woman and their dogs.
You know, there are these studies that have been done about pets and human health and wellness. There was one famous one about 20, 30 years old. About a study of hypertensive stockbrokers who had had heart attacks. And after the fact, half of the study population were given dogs and half was not given dogs. And the ones who had been given dogs showed a much lower rate of recurrence. You know, and there's this sense, I think, that all of us humans have of, you know, when there is something out there that needs you, an animal or a human, someone who can't read, you know, labels on food for themselves and someone who can't fend for themselves. You're depressed. It's a reason to get out of bed in the morning. It's an obligation. It's something you got to do because no one else is going to do. You know, one of the things I stumbled across sort of inadvertently as I reported this was a website run by the public health authorities in San Francisco, and it was encouraging gay men to get tested for syphilis, which is, you know, not something that really has anything to do with dogs. But the argument they used, the site was called Dogs Are Talking, and the argument they used was if you get sick, no one will be able to take care of your dog, and you would never want that to happen.
Interesting. Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, also open up the phones. Michael Schaefer is our guest, and we're talking about his new book. It's called One Nation Under Dog, and it's subtitled Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food, all of which we'll talk about after this short break, and we'll take calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater supports WHYY, presenting the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged by Adam Long, Daniel Singer, and Jess Winfield, running through May 10th. This comedy takes the audience on a tour of all of Shakespeare's plays. More information and tickets to the complete works of William Shakespeare, abridged, available from the box office by phone at 215-496-8001 or online at phillyshakespeare.org.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY at 11:20. Ahead at noon on Here and Now, hear about how the recession affects the music we listen to by comparing Billboard hits to the S&P 500. The WHYY forecast, a sunny afternoon, high 64 degrees. Clouding up overnight, low 42. Tomorrow, cloudy with rain developing and a chance of a late-day thunderstorm, high near 60. Clearing Saturday, windy, high 54. Sunny on Sunday, up to 57 degrees.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and this week on Wiretap, a weekend alone in the woods turns out to be less like Walden Pond and more like the Blair Witch Project. Oh my god. Oh my god, oh my god. What is that? Plus, a brand new story from Heather O'Neill. That's this week's Wiretap from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So do you treat your pet like a child? Is your pet named Jack or Mary? Give us a call here on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. Our guest is writer and journalist Michael Schaefer, and he's the author of this new book called One Nation Under Dog. Here's a clip from Best in Show.
What do you want? What do you want more than anything in the world? You want the big blue ribbon? Uh-huh, that's what you want. You want red? No, you don't want red. You want yellow? No, you don't want yellow. You want to go home with the blue. What do you see in front of me? What do you see in front of me? You see a big blue ribbon. It's right here in front of you. You want it? You come and you grab it. You get it.
She's not listening to you. She's nervous. She's freaking out.
Well, get the busy bee. You want your busy bee. You get your busy bee.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers. It's in the crate.
Where is it?
It's in the crate.
Why didn't you have it out to begin with? Where are the crate? It's not in here. It's not in here.
It should be in the crate.
It's not in the crate. I just told you that.
God, Hamilton, if she doesn't get a door, she's going to flip out.
Yeah. It's not in here. You left it at the hotel. You go back and you get her busy bee. Go to the hotel and get busy bee. Run. Run. Go. Mommy's getting your toy. Don't you worry. No, we just had a little, discussion. Look at me. Look at me. Don't look at anybody else. Don't look at the fat losers or freaks. You look at me.
I could hear that a million times, and it still cracks me up. And that is from Best in Show. Actors Michael Hitchcock and Parker Posey prepping their dog in the grooming area backstage from a national dog show. Now, your book, Michael, is not about dog shows, but I love that clip because it just the obsessive focus on the dog, the busy bee, mommy, daddy, all of that.
Right. It's, you know, there is so much crazy, crazy, crazy gear out there. That you can, you know, I went each year as I was reporting this book, I would go to this show called the Global Pet Expo, which is the annual pet industry trade show. And it's, you know, an enormous, massive trade show. And it's, you know, every last puppy T-shirt and blinking leash and canine mineral water and organic kitty litter box and ferret hammock and stroller for macaw. And, you know, you could really see like the various trends in our human world
exactly
sort of playing out in real time. You know, for the first year I went, it was sort of the tail end of the Paris Hilton thing, and there were these a lot of these strollers and things like that. The last couple years, it's been really going green with all these environmental claims about pet stuff. Some of them real, some of them I wouldn't really want to research.
And you also talk about this phrase, I guess, that the pet food industry has come up with, this idea. I've never heard of it, to be honest with you, but something called a fur baby, which really is this idea that your pet is your baby.
Right. And it, you know, it's at once kind of a reflection of how a lot of people live, but also the kind of subtle encouragement that, hey, if you're not living that way, maybe there's something a little wrong with you. You know, and you see it, you know, one of the pet pharmaceutical lines, their website is petparents.com. Uh-huh. So you're supposed to consider yourself like a parent to the pet. And that's not an inaccurate description. I mean, you are ultimately the provider and carer for this animal that can't do for itself. But it really does show the extent of things because, you know, I had begun my reporting thinking I was going to be spending a lot of time in the like crazy Paris Hilton, Leona Helmsley extremes of society. And I wound up writing a great deal about ordinary middle-class American families.
But you do write about, I mean, you do write about a pool party for a Chihuahua, for instance.
Right. I spent a lot of time with this woman who is the organizer of the New York area Chihuahua meetup group. And she has these parties for people with Chihuahuas. Hundreds and hundreds of people come, and there is a summertime pool party, which had you know, swimming and doggy ice cream and cake and all the a lot of the people dressed their dogs up with sort of swimming goggles and so on. There's a Thanksgiving party, a Halloween party. I also went to the Christmas party. There was a Santa, so people and their dogs could pose on Santa's lap. Everyone sort of dressed their dogs up in these, you know, I've been naughty kind of T-shirts. And, you know, the thing is, it would be really easy to make fun of them because it's really silly. On the other hand, these are people who, you know, God bless them, they found community with one another through their pets. And you know, it's not that easy for people to encounter one another. And people had made genuine friendships, like the sort where you don't just talk about your pets, although people talked a lot about their pets.
I bet they did.
And I found that to be pretty incredible.
Well, what she says to you, I was invisible before the dogs. Now I never have any time. It's like a new family, all the Chihuahua people. But the idea, and I think this is also true for parents, and I don't want to, you know, make this association too many times during this hour, mm-hmm. but I think parents will also say that when you have a baby in a stroller, people say, oh, so cute. Is it a boy? Is it a girl? I guess a pet in a stroller gets the same kind of reaction.
Right, and people are incredibly open and forthcoming in talking about their pets. I mean, I found that as a reporter, and I'm sure you just find it sort of as a stranger on the street mm-hmm. as well. You know, when I was in Austin as part of my reporting, I was walking around and passed this bar. It had a little sign that said, I think it was a Wednesday night, it said, tonight, yappy hour. And, you know, sure enough, it was like a happy hour for people with mm-hmm. pets, and they'd put out some bones and some biscuits and bowls and so on. And, you know, great idea for filling a bar on a quiet night of the week because, first of all, if you have to walk your dog anyway,
right.
you might as well combine that with
right.
doing something social for you. A lot of people feel that way.
And have a little beer while you're
and
at
it. You know, it was sort of an event, and people were happy about that. But it, you know, really does show a serious thing, which is mm-hmm. the kind of centrality of pets in a lot of people's lives. And the fact that business and so on are picking up on that.
Well, and hotels, a perfect example of either dog hotels or hotels where you can bring your dog.
Right. I mean, there's sort of all these activities that we humans do, from going on vacation to going to yoga. There was the New York Times had a story this morning about doga. And also, I mean, there's a sort of a sadder element of this, too. I mean, there were studies that found that one of the major reasons cited by people who don't leave abusive spouses is fear for what the abuser might do to a pet that gets left behind. Now, shelters, women's shelters and so on, traditionally didn't take pets. I mean, this is a high turnover kind of place where you don't do that. Having kind of absorbed some of this information, a number of them have either changed their policies to make themselves pet friendly or partnered with groups that will take care of the pet while you're staying there. But it's, you know, it's a pretty incredible thing that, you know, people will leave themselves in a very bad situation because they want to protect their pet. They saw the same thing around Hurricane Katrina.
Well, I was just going to say, all those moving, poignant stories of people that would not leave their home
right.
while the water was rising because of their dog.
And in the wake of that, Congress passed a bill that said, you know, all localities with disaster plans had to include mm-hmm. Pets in their disaster plans, which was remarkable because there actually was no similar requirement for humans.
But there was one for dogs.
Right, right.
Do you see this as pathological, or do you see, I realize you're a journalist, but mm-hmm. nonetheless, I mean, the fact that people seem to be so connected to, so related to their dog.
I think like anything, you find some pathological stuff in there. I mean, there are these obsessive hoarders and so on. And you find some excess and some consumerism mm-hmm. and so on. I think for the most part, though, you know, most of what people do for their pets are consumer choices. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's $45 billion a year, is the projection for 2009. But if you actually divide that by the number of pets there are in the country, it's not that much. It's gone way up, but it's still not that much. And I guess I just sort of feel like we do enough stuff that we really ought to feel ashamed about. I mean, we buy ourselves a lot of stupid, frivolous, self-centered stuff, and we do a lot of stupid, frivolous, self-centered behaviors. And I on that list, I would put pets pretty low. I don't think that it's something that we really ought to be beating ourselves up about.
Then do you buy organic dog food for Murphy?
He didn't like the organic. He gets a pretty good brand, but he's a picky guy for a St. Bernard especially. But, you know, I think the way food works, the way pet food works, it's It's a remarkable parallel to our human food. And you can learn a lot about our sort of values of human food. And people attach so much of it. I mean, I bet you when Obama gets a dog, there's going to be a story.
Which is imminent, right? Because
that blessed event is about to happen. I bet you there'll be stories about what kind of food are they feeding it. And they've already, the family has already made a show of, you know, we're going to have local ingredients. We're going to plant this garden in the White House. You know, there's a sort of pet parallel to that. But, you know, a generation ago, we all, most of us, shopped at something like Safeway. And now you've got, you know, some of the population's at sort of Whole Foods and some of the population is at Walmart and some of the population has, like, gone off the grid and goes to farmers markets and so on. You see the same thing in pet food. You see this, particularly at the more healthful end of the market, this just incredibly creative. And stuff that was the top of the line 2 years ago is now, you know, the real hardcore nutritious pet people are going to say, ugh, that stuff is, that, you know, that's corporate hogwash. And it's incredible. It's sort of organic, and then it's human grade, and then it's raw, because after all, in the wild, animals don't have food that looks like baked breakfast cereal. They're going to go and hunt their prey, and we should try to replicate that as best we can because we owe it to them.
And that's Michael Schaefer, our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about dogs, the subject of his new book called One Nation Under Dog, and it's subtitled Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. I do want to talk about dog park politics because, mm-hmm. again, you know, this is an interesting window into human behavior as well as canine behavior. Do you take Murphy to a dog park?
I take him to the park in our neighborhood, and it's not officially a dog park, and I think we're actually breaking the rules by letting him off leash. I don't feel particularly bad about that.
But there are organized dog parks that with what seem, I'm not familiar with them, that they're not, there isn't one locally available in my neighborhood where you can take a dog and do the dog park thing, but
right.
It must be interesting just to see the sort of hierarchy and how things are divided right. within dog parks. Talk about that a bit, if you would.
There's two kinds of politics at play. I mean, one is the sort of politics like with the government and stuff, which is that, you know, I think it shows the centrality and the devotion people have to pets, and in this case, dogs, that, you know, people really are fighting to, you know, you should either not enforce the rules against off-leash dogs or you should create a dedicated dog park out of this shared public resource that is an open space. Mm-hmm. The same way that other people might fight to have a basketball court there or an amphitheater or anything else. I mean, it's an interest group in society and an interest group which I write about. I spent some time in San Francisco where it's been an enormous issue, and there were marches on City Hall, and the dog owners set up a PAC which endorsed political candidates. And politicians would come hat in hand to this group, you know, what can we do for you to make it easier to be a dog owner in San Francisco? That's a city where there's more dogs than children.
Is that right?
Right. So, which actually, you know, since one of the arguments against letting dogs off leash is always, you know, what about the children? This is going to get in the way of soccer. I mean, those are legitimate arguments. They're just arguments that have less power when there's
when there are so many children around.
The other part of dog park politics is the kind of what goes on in these places and what it says about the community around it. And I know that, you know, where our dog romps in Philadelphia, we live in University City, and it's a kind of academic neighborhood, mm-hmm. and the attitude tends to be kind of dogs will be dogs when dogs do certain behaviors.
Doggy things, yeah.
That some people feel uncomfortable about. And in our park, it tends to be, well, you know, that's just what they do. You go someplace else, though, and people have a very different attitude and might be quite uncomfortable with that. And the funny thing is there's never written rules about this stuff. I mean, sometimes there are some rules, mm-hmm. but it's like a self-enforcing system. And, you know, how we correct someone who, you know, God forbid, doesn't clean up after their dog. People do it. People are rarely aggressive enough to say, hey, pick that up. It's a kind of passive-aggressive, you know.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's nice to pick up your poop. But it actually does say a lot about the people who are in the park and the kind of community and culture they come from.
I also think about, and it's always, I think it's a sort of a mob psychology thing, when you're new to something that's been ongoing, the kind of politics and
right.
who accepts you and what kind of dog you have and does the dog fit mm-hmm. in with all the other dogs?
Right. You know, I felt a little bit like, you know, Margaret Mead, you know, stepping off the boat in Samoa or something. Or actually the most practical parallel I could think of was joining a gym. You know, you join a gym and there are some rules, but, you know, for the most part, you're just watching everyone else to see what they do. Do they towel off their machine or whatever? And then you kind of do what they do. And for a while, you're sort of obsessed with it because it's, you know, you're watching this sort of social ritual.
What's the culture
and
here,
trying
right?
to figure it out. And it's the same thing at the dog park. You're just trying to make sure you get everything right. And I think most people are conformists and do want to do what is expected from them within the community they're in.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. We got a full bank, and we've got, looks like Diana from Kennett Square joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Diana. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I have a lab mix. She's 12 years old. She was diagnosed with diabetes a year ago, and we just gave her cataract surgery about 6 weeks ago. I didn't even know there was such a thing possible, but my friends thought we were crazy to do it. My husband said, we have the money, let's do it. It was partially successful, but I have to say she's the most expensive dog, the most expensive free dog I've ever had. I love her dearly. I love all dogs. But it is amazing when you go into these specialty centers for animals, how many people are in there with their dogs with eye problems, with cancer, with, you know, all different kinds of things that happen. And people are in there taking care of them.
Absolutely. And Diana, how much did you pay for this eye surgery?
I think when I'm all done with the drops, which are astronomical, probably about $6,000.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Well, I know it's crazy. We have a teenage daughter, and she just keeps saying, don't spend my college funds on the dog. You know? And we tell her we don't. And especially in the times we're in right now, it has been a little rough. But we just thought we would never live ourselves, you know, we would never be able to live it down if we didn't try it.
Well, you know, so Diane, you know, you represent, I think, a lot of people who just have such passionate feelings about their dogs. And it sounds crazy on the one hand, but on the other hand, it's perfectly logical. Michael Schaefer, your thoughts?
I mean, veterinary medicine has changed so much. You know, and right here in Philadelphia, there is, you know, one of the best vet hospitals in the world. And so much of the creative stuff, it's happening on the pet side, not on the large animal side and so on. You know, I sat with a couple doctors there for a week where I was watching these incredible...
This is Penn, right?
In Penn, yeah.
Yep.
I was watching these incredible procedures. It was like Fantastic Voyage. You know, they were doing minimally invasive surgeries to treat cancers. They were using stents to keep open passageways that would have been occluded by the cancer. And at one point, I'd watched this very elaborate, time-consuming interventional radiology procedure. And we were all sort of dressed up like spacemen, you know, in these lead outfits and so on. And at the end of it, the doctor said, you know, the thing about this is it's purely palliative. This dog is still going to die from this cancer. It's not going to die as fast mm-hmm. because of what we just did. And, you know, for some people, having an extra 9 months, which is, I guess, a lot longer in human years, is worth it, and they'll spend the money for that. For other people, it's not. But you know, it's at Penn they're pioneers of feline kidney transplants. Now that's a pretty incredible procedure. It costs like more than $10,000. There's two teams of surgeons operating at the same time. It's particularly remarkable when you think that the first journal of feline medicine is only 40 or so years old. Hmm. I mean, that didn't exist. And the idea that people would pay for life-extending surgeries, particularly life-extending against such long odds and such foes like cancer and so on, is pretty incredible. It reflects a lot of our human medicine. I mean, people will say to vets, hey, you know, my Aunt Mildred had cataract surgery. Can you do the same for my dog? And there's this expectation that it's available. But then once it's available, it creates its own energy, I think, and people feel...
Say no to something like that?
I will be remiss. This is an animal that's done nothing but love me.
Diana, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We'll take some more calls after this very short break. Let me quickly reintroduce our guest, Michael Schaefer. He's a journalist, a writer, and he's got a new book, One Nation Underdog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
JerseyArts.com supports WHYY, featuring details on upcoming events, including the New Jersey State Museum's Super Science Weekend, Saturday and Sunday, April 25th and 26th, in Trenton's Capitol Complex, featuring 2 days of activities for all ages surrounding science, and the new exhibit, Rising Tide, Climate Change in New Jersey. Details at njstatemuseum.org. The New Jersey State Museum and more online at JerseyArts.com.
It's 11:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY-FM. Ahead at noon, here and now. And then at 2 on Talk of the Nation, a look at challenges for Secretary of Defense Robert Gates. He's putting together a budget with one eye on Congress and the other on threats troops might face in the future. The WHYY forecast, a high of 64 degrees this afternoon under sunny skies. Turning cloudy overnight, low 42. Tomorrow, rain on the way, maybe even a thunderstorm, high 59.
I'm Deborah Becker. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Trouble at the Times. Is America's flagship paper a sinking ship? Also, does the recession affect the music we listen to? We'll compare Billboard hits to the S&P 500. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Michael Schaefer. He's a writer. He's a journalist. He's written for the Washington City Paper, the U.S. News and World Report, the Philadelphia Inquirer. He now writes for Slate and the New Republic, among other publications. And he's got a new book we've been talking about called One Nation Under Dog. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Michael, you do have this chapter on Pet Fashion Week. Not surprisingly, there is such a thing.
Right. You know,
what happens there?
Well, Pet Fashion Week is this annual trade show of items that are supposed to be sold at boutique pet stores. These cutesy little stores that are probably one in your neighborhood too.
I'm sure there is.
And not in PetSmart and stuff like that. And the penultimate event of this week is an actual runway show, and there are these very tall supermodel looking models who walk dogs down the runway, which are in these couture outfits. And the show is really about trying to kind of upsell at every point and to be very classy and to turn the doggy designers into celebrities. I noticed yesterday the Fashion Institute of Technology, the sort of premier FIT school, has announced that they too are going to have a pet fashion show for students this spring who will design clothes for pets. They really try to make it a very serious business. It doesn't quite work. At the end, at the show, when they bring the dogs down the aisle, down the runway.
Yeah.
The people in the crowd, the music's low and the lights are low and it's all like a fashion show, except that everyone goes, "Oh, that's so cute." And I don't think that happens at real fashion shows.
And whether those dogs get that kind of walk that, human fashion models have, where they barely move their hips.
Right.
They just sort of glide down the runway there.
I'll say this, that when I went, everyone's like, "Remember last year there was an accident, an accident." Oh. And this year there was one, it was very sweet. They had, instead of having these purebred dogs, they had dogs from shelters who were mixed breeds, rescue dogs. And one of the dogs suddenly got quite nervous in the spotlights, as should be expected.
Sure.
And the model, with a tremendous grace, just swooped him up and took him into her arms and kept walking, lest there be any trouble.
And everyone really went, "Aw."
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Let me get Diane from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. Excuse me. Hi, Diane. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much. I've got so many things to say, I don't even know where to start. But I do want to start with, I am a psychotherapist, and one of the things that has moved me so much is how important animals are in people's lives. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with who were very close to suiciding, and when I asked them what stopped them from doing it, they would say, "My dog." Sure. "Or my cats." Not my kids. "My dog or my cats." And I don't think that human animal bond is so incredibly intense in our society, maybe because we've become so disconnected from one another. But the other thing I wanted to mention is the lengths to which people are going today to save animals' lives and to protect animals. This is something that there's this funny, silly side of the animal-human relationship.
Sure.
That you've been talking about, but then there's this very serious and intense effort to get animals, for instance, out of killing shelters, transporting them up from the south, people who are just devoting their lives to doing this. It's incredible. I wondered if he did any work with people like this who are involved in animal welfare groups, animal advocacy groups, animal rescues.
Well, you know what, Diana, I appreciate you calling in. And actually, our guests also did spend some time looking at puppy mills in Pennsylvania. Unfortunately, Pennsylvania has the dubious reputation, or at least parts of the state, for being the puppy mill capital of the world. But go ahead, Michael Schaefer.
If you look at the argument, people have always said don't buy pets from pet stores. 10, 20 years ago, the argument would have been it's because you're going to get a bad product. It was like a consumer protection argument. You know, the animals are more likely to be sick or ill-behaved, that sort of thing. Nowadays, the argument is completely different. It's you will be perpetuating this system of cruelty, these puppy mills and so on. And, you know, instead of it being one of these animal welfare arguments that is trying to get some stranger or someplace to change their behavior and sort of, you know, applying our values to a farmer someplace and so on, it's actually asking pet people to live up to their own values. That is, you are adopting this animal, you're supposed to be taking it into your home, and you're increasingly likely to love it selflessly and for its own sake. If you feel that way, you can't perpetuate a system where its mom or its dad is being kept for years and years and years in a tiny, tiny, painful little cage and being bred season after season after season and being discarded by being killed when it's no longer of any use. That's a kind of betrayal of the values that have become, you know, sort of become your basic pet world values. It's interesting how the sales pitch against puppy mills and against pet stores has changed in that way.
But, you know, I find, and if you go to a mall or to a movie in the mall, and there's one that I go to that has a little pet store there, and I have to go and look at the puppies, I mean, it does put you in such a strange situation, because on the one hand, these are live little creatures.
Right.
But on the other hand, we know, as you say, more and more where these animals are coming from.
Right. And I mean, it's the whole world of pet breeding is a strange anomaly in this business. I mean, as I was doing my reporting, I met these consumer research people, and they could tell you down to a great detail, you know, how many upscale brands of doggy shampoo were sold in the year 2005. But people have only the foggiest idea of where pets come from, and it's because most people who have a brand name to protect don't want anything to do with that business. Because even for a reputable, humane, decent breeder, there is a little bit of a cultural divide between them and you, the pet owner. Because, you know, our attitude towards pets, particularly now, is this sort of, you know, love them for their own sake, don't apply stupid, superficial judgments to them. And then, you know, a breeder will... Even a good breeder will be like, oh, that's sort of a subpar paw on that beagle. Or, you know, such and such Labrador, his bloodline goes all the way back to so-and-so. And it's very sort of out of place and anachronistic in our society, which increasingly celebrates our sort of mongrel nature, to have this world where there's this sort of obsession with purity and bloodlines there. And very good breeders who are... You can be very humane,
sure,
and all that, are still quite unsentimental about pets in the way that you or I might be sentimental about them.
Which I think explains some of this obsession over the Obama's dog.
Right.
And is it going to be a shelter dog? Is it going to be a mixed breed? Is it going to be this? Is it going to be
right.
that? And it's almost, you know, it's almost who do you choose to be in your cabinet
right.
in terms of a decision.
I mean, it's like everything about having pets now is like a little symbol of what your broad values are. What kind of pet you get, where you get it from.
What's the story behind the pet?
What sort of training do you do? Do you do this sort of old-fashioned, top-down, very authoritarian training that has been kind of revived by Cesar Millan? Or do you do the type of training that came into fashion in the 70s and continues to be the predominant type, which is this more forgiving, easygoing, positive approach? That, you know, is... on one level, just a choice about, well, what's the best way to teach my dog not to jump at people at the door? But it also comes with all of these value judgments, and it's incredibly stressful for people. But it does say a great deal about our society. You know, this stuff that's like, okay, we're this goofy pet pampering society. Actually, we're, you know, our pets are a pretty good reflection of us.
And which of those training systems did you end up using?
We used the Cesar Millan type, and we had idea what we were doing. I mean, this was before I had been doing any research on this. We just, you know, we were going to have a baby. We were thinking about having a baby, and we had that sort of paranoia that people have of, oh, no, the dog's going to eat the baby or something. So we found a woman who we liked a great deal and who had a nice website and so on. And You know, and she had, that was sort of this, you know, the basic argument that we've lost our way with our dogs because we have allowed them to not be sure who's the boss and that they're very anxious in this situation. If we need to, if we reassert our status as the alpha, things will be all right again. And, you know, my feeling is that she never advocated anything cruel or inhumane or whatnot.
It's the whole alpha
right.
Relationship.
Although that can probably elide a little more easily into that stuff. You know, I think for like 95% of pets, doing something consistently is fine, and not being cruel. But it is loaded with the same sorts of things. Just like, what, you know, are you going to do attachment parenting, or are you going to send your kid to Montessori? I mean, these really stress parents out, and it's the same thing with pets in the sense that, you know, who am I? You know, what are my politics in this society, and how does that play out in how I treat my pets? People are going to be watching every little detail of Obama's pet.
Well, and you're living this as well with a new baby and a new dog as well.
Right.
Let me get David from Glenside to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have David? David from Glenside, number 6. Yes, go ahead. Hi, David. You're on Radio Times. Nope. Let's go up to Lisa from Califon, New Jersey. Hi, Lisa. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty.
Hi
How
there.
Are you? I
Good.
Love your show.
Thank
I listen
you.
Every day while I'm grooming dogs.
Great.
And my husband and I, when we got our first dog in 1986, we just were heartbroken to have to leave her to go to work every day, and we decided to change our lives completely. And we now run a boarding kennel very successfully in northwest New Jersey, where we could be with our dogs as well as other people's dogs. We felt it was really important to provide a place where we would feel comfortable leaving our own dogs.
Well, listen, we can hear some of those dogs barking in the background.
I haven't shut the dryers for a little while.
No, I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. You know, I was also reading, Michael, about places where people can take their dogs, kennels. I'm not sure whether Lisa has this or not, where they actually put TV sets in with the dogs.
Yeah, I think that people feel like Lisa felt. They feel terribly guilty. And, you know, it's, again, a very new feature of pet ownership. Used to be you'd take... If you had to go out of town and you had a dog and you were feeling so inclined, you would take your dog to the vet, and the vet would have a few kennels. And you know, because it's the vet's office, the dog would be well cared for. But that's not good enough for a lot of people. You know, don't you dare call it a kennel anymore.
Exactly.
It's now a doggy day spa or a hotel or something. I went to a place in San Francisco called WAG Hotel, which the top rate was $85 a night.
Wow.
And I've heard of more expensive ones than that. There was art on the wall. There were flat-screen TVs in the room. There was a little webcam attached to the wall, which was pointed at you know, the very nice doggy bed, and you, the dog owner, you know, presumably on vacation someplace or, you know, in Hawaii or whatever, can log on and look at the webcam image of your dog. And the people who work there told me they get calls from people who say, you know, hey. Buster looks kind of hungry. Can you send up some room service, which they will do for an additional charge?
And they do have room service at this WAG Hotel.
Yes.
Wow. Let me get Gregory from Drexel Hill to join our conversation. Hi, Gregory. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about, remember when people were giving foster care to dogs from Hurricane Katrina?
Sure.
And then they didn't want to return the dogs to the people because they said they were abusing them because they weren't doing special things for them because some of the dogs weren't spayed. And I don't know. It just seems like a kind of a dog snobbery. It seems a little... counterproductive to me. It seemed a little crazy.
Well, there is dog snobbery. There's no question about that, Gregory. Let me see what Michael Schaefer says.
Oh, plus I wanted to say also, at what point do you get with a dog where the animal, are you doing the animal any good when you prolong its life through extraordinary medical purposes, or are you doing it for you, or are you making the animal suffer? I was always wondering.
Well,
you know?
And I think that's almost like a case-by-case basis, and it's also a question I think we ask when we have a human being who's also very seriously ill.
Those are both really good questions.
Yeah.
You know, there's a big cultural gap in the country about how pets are treated. You see it even in you know, within cities and within neighborhoods. And it doesn't quite track with economics or anything like that. But, you know, in certain cities on the coasts, the spay-neuter thing has been incredibly, incredibly successful. And it was used to be the sort of goofy thing that Bob Barker said on The Price is Right, you know. And You know, in New York City, in San Francisco, the number of unwanted animals has gone way, way down. And there are actually, you know, one of the previous callers alluded to this, there are these kind of underground railroad shipments of pets from the heartland from the south up to the cities of the northeast. You know, it also tends to be, more sadly, that a lot of the dogs that are available in shelters in the cities are pit bulls and so on, which are not always bad dogs, but which a lot of people don't want. And they're much happier if sort of a hound dog from Arkansas turns up as a result of one of these rescue trips.
Well, and we're almost out of time here, but just picking up on that. I mean, there are these two very different worlds. There's the doggy fashion shows that you write about, but there are also, you know, these pit bulls that are, and as you say, these are good breeds, but they have been hurt by their owners and taught to basically fight and kill and right. live a terrible life.
Right. You know, there's sort of two kinds of pet stories. You know, you can open up the paper any given week and you'll find a sort of, hey, it's, you know, the guy who buys a fashion jacket for his dog. You can also find terrible stories regularly of animals being abused, of pets being abandoned by people who kind of don't have a choice or maybe do have a choice but aren't very nice. You know, I think long term, that second kind of story is becoming rarer.
Uh-huh.
I think Michael Vick, I don't consider his animals to have been pets. I mean, I think of pet as like having no economic point, and his dogs, obviously he was trying to make money by winning these dog fights, and that's why he was so mad that he killed them when they lost.
Yeah.
And that's different from having pets. But I do think that you know, there's never a time in history when what he did would be considered good or even unobjectionable. But the hatred that people feel for him is, I think, also a measure of how strongly people feel now about our pets. And I don't think that always was there.
Well, much more to talk about. Michael Schaefer, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is One Nation Underdog, Adventures in the New World of Prozac Popping Puppies, Dog Park Politics, and Organic Pet Food. And it's published by Henry Holt. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us. And you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station, sir. Serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And we had to end with this song, going back to Best in Show.
God loves a terrier. Yes, he does. God loves a terrier. That's because small, sturdy, bright, and true. They give their love to you. God didn't miss a stitch. Be it dog or be it bitch, when he made the Norwich merrier with its cute little derriere. Yes, God loves a terrier.